And welcome back, everybody, to the Hangout in the Holy Land, the official podcast of LandGrantHolyLand.com, your free premier resource for all things Ohio State athletics news. I am your intrepid host, Matt Brown. You can follow me at MattSBN on Twitter, and you can follow our blog at LandGrant33. We are on all manner of social networks. It's good to be recording here. This is a sleepy, rainy, gross morning here on Thursday, February 9th. I think this will probably publish tomorrow. And I don't know about all of you, but I already feel a little bit rejuvenated because now that National Signing Day is in the rearview mirror, even though we've got basketball, we've got a really good women's basketball team here at Ohio State, we have some other exciting other sports that are happening right now, that kind of really closes the door on football season and allows me to finally catch my breath for a hot second here. I know, like, I'm complaining here about being a professional sports blog person, which means I should be immediately shot into the sun. But it's nice to have a little bit of, nice to have a little bit of a break. We went down to North Carolina for a couple of days after NSD. We'll be going back again tomorrow, so you may not see me immediately on the internet. But just because I'm going to be gone for a little bit, and just because now that National Signing Day is over and the 2016 season and 2015 season is really completely in the books, it doesn't mean that there aren't things for us to talk about, especially even with recruiting and football. And to help us make sense of some of those things, I'm joined once again by my friend, Mr. Colton Denning. What's good, brother? What's good, brother?
Not much, Matt. It's early morning here in Boulder, Colorado. I got a new microphone for the podcast, so I kind of look at it as, you know how, like, Ohio State or Texas A&M, any of these big-name schools, even the mid-majors, they pump money into their facilities to tell the people, to tell their fans, hey, we're getting better. We are doing stuff for the players, for this program, for the community. That's what I'm doing when I get this microphone. So, Land Grant Holy Land podcast, in the podcast studio, in the community. That's our slogan.
And in the classroom. We are leaders and legends all over the place. Come a long way from the very early versions of the show when I was sharing a microphone with three other people and it was not great, as people routinely let me know via email and Twitter. So I'm happy for you. Did you get a corporate sponsorship for the microphone? Is it like the Pete Coors Memorial, you know, Colton mic?
In a perfect world, it would be, but this was an out-of-pocket purchase, much like Todd Graham, I think, pumping almost $1 million into ASU facilities. That's what I'm doing here, except without the Britney Spears type of microphone that Todd Graham uses, and without the job hopping as well.
I didn't hear about that. That's probably pretty smart. If you're waiting on, like, your trustees to come up with the dough, if you're, you know, plan on actually being somewhere for a while, which is a weird thing to say here about Todd Graham, but this is the year of our Lord 2016. Crazy things are happening.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was $1 million. I think it was at least $500,000, but he put money into that new stadium that they're getting either next year or the year after. So it seems like you said, we're talking about Todd Graham to start the podcast. So whatever, but he pumped the money in. So that's something you really don't see with coaches.
Yeah, starting with Todd Graham was not exactly what I had here on my notes, but we're happy to go with that. Speaking of pumping money and resources into programs, it looks like we've certainly seen the after effects of that for programs who are doing that with recruiting. National Signing Day finished up here last week. I know we talked a lot about the particular players and everything here. On my end of the desk, it seemed like it was the calmest and easiest National Signing Day since I think since Land Grant's really been a thing. Did anything happen at all during that day? I mean, either Ohio State or just big picture that surprised you?
No, not really. I think the least surprising thing was that Alabama had, what, 15 or 16 commits, and everybody knew that they were going to close out as strong as they did. They had the in-state five-star linebacker Ben Davis sign with them. So I don't think that there was too many surprises. And I agree with you that from an Ohio State perspective, nothing really, I think, shocked us with how they kind of finished out the class. I wasn't positive that Malcolm Pridgen was going to sign with Ohio State, but that came down on National Signing Day. So I think if you're looking for something that was maybe a bit of a surprise, it was that. But other than that, Ohio State had the class locked up. They had pretty much everybody in. Mark Pantone put out a tweet saying that everybody that was committed from, I think, November on never even took a visit anywhere else. So this was a pretty strong class in terms of kids that were dead set on going to Ohio State.
Yeah, this was definitely light on drama. The past couple of seasons, Ohio State's had, you know, some big name person who they weren't sure they were going to get or expected, you know, something big to happen on that actual day. The 2016 class, you're right, was not just locked up early, but like super locked up early, where over a dozen kids weren't even taking any other visits, and a lot of them committed relatively early on in the process. Just two kids were picked up on the actual day. Malcolm Pridgen, who we already talked about on the last show, four-star, you know, just a huge dude, JUCO offensive lineman, will be coming to campus a little bit later. I don't believe he's going to be in Columbus for spring practice, but he is expected to compete for playing time. And then you had Malik Harrison, the kind of wide receiver, linebacker, defensive back, all everything, local three-star kid out of Walnut Ridge. So that class is finished up. The Buckeyes do finish with the top-ranked class in the Big Ten. They signed 25 kids. They finished fourth in the 247 football composite team rankings. They beat out Michigan, who signed four more players to hang on here to that fourth spot. And that means – so that's all done. That's excellent. We've talked about who may be playing early. Obviously, enormous amounts of things are going to change between now and next National Signing Day. But it seems like Ohio State has already put in the foundation to have another, if not superior, recruiting class for 2017.
Yeah, and if you look at the class right now at 24/7, you have 10 what they call hard commits right now. Josh Myers, who's a top 10 prospect, ranked third nationally. Sean Wade from Jacksonville, Florida. He's 12th nationally, the cornerback. They're in on a couple kids from Florida. Isaiah Pryor is another commit from Florida. Jake Moretti from out here in Colorado, the offensive tackles in the top 100, and then Marcus Williamson from Ohio. And this is something I think you know more about, but I think the strength in this class is not only them going after Florida recruits, but 2017 seems pretty loaded in Ohio recruits in the state. Danny Clark is one kid that's committed with Ohio State, but other than that, they have already, I want to say, five kids in the state locked up, including the stud running back, Todd Sibley.
I think that just generally, the top-end talent or the depth and talent for Ohio high school football has, you know, compared to how things were maybe in the 90s, may not quite be as high given the population changes and everything in Ohio State. Certainly recruits Florida and Georgia and lots of places nationally. But right now, you're right, 2017 does look like it's going to be a very strong Ohio class. Right now, the Buckeyes have four of the top five and five of the top seven kids in the state, all blue chips, already locked up. And the third, Jalen Harris, big wideout from Cleveland Heights, got an Ohio State offer. He's expected to be a pretty big Buckeye lean. So it would not be surprising at all if Ohio State locks down the top five kids in the state and then kind of, you know, is able to pick and choose. There's some really good wide receivers as a group in Ohio. There's some good defensive backs, which Ohio State always needs more from. And what's a little bit different, just at the very top end in the state for 2017, is that the very best kids are not coming from the parochial programs around Cincinnati. That's historically some of the best high school football in Ohio. And that's also the system where maybe Ohio State has had the least amount of dominance. Notre Dame has been very successful in some of those schools. Some national programs have been successful there. And Ohio State's been able to get some kids too. But if you're looking at a place where Ohio State may not get an in-state kid that they want, it's typically from that region at a Catholic program. And this year, the two of the top five kids are from Columbus. You know, one's from Westerville South, and one's at Olentangy Liberty. And Ohio State virtually never misses on those guys. And there's a lot more public school kids and a lot more people from around the state. So I would feel confident, just not even knowing the specific cases of the kids, Ohio State's going to do really well there. You've got 10 kids already committed. Nine of them are blue chips. Two of them are consensus five stars. And the one who isn't a blue chip is a kicker. And he's not rated right now, but it will probably be, you know, a mid three-star kid. So that's excellent. One thing that Urban Meyer did mention in his press conference after the National Signing Day last week was when someone had asked him about the 2017 class. The early scuttlebutt is that this is not going to be a very big class unless there's a lot of roster turnover over the next year. I don't think Ohio State is expecting the same level of kids leaving early to clear for the NFL draft like they did from this year, when basically everybody and their brother left. So it's a smaller senior class. like half the kids on this roster still have freshman eligibility. So this isn't the group where you're going to be able to take 26, 27, 28 kids unless a bunch of people leave. So we're already right now, this class might be half locked up or close to half locked up. And he did mention that he did not expect all 10 of these commitments to stick. Since right now this has a pretty strong Ohio flavor, I know I would just hazard a guess that a lot of other programs are going to be in on Sean Wade and Isaiah Pryor. Those are two of the very highly regarded defensive backs. They're both from Florida. Would not shock me if one of them ultimately did not sign with Ohio State. But either way, I know kind of a broken record. Next year should be very good, and there's a lot of reasons for Ohio State to be really excited about what the future is going to bring.
Well, and you bring up the Florida kids. If there's anything we know about Florida recruiting, it's that when high-level talent commits early, they always stay committed.
Absolutely. There's definitely not ever a track record of other established programs coming in and talking to kids, especially in South Florida, who may be interested in another program. This is obviously going to be very fluid because it's freaking February right now. We still have an evaluation period. A lot of these kids, their rating is going to change quite a bit. I wouldn't be shocked if Ohio State is still sitting at maybe like 11 or 12 commits as we head really into the summer. There might only be one or two people who are going to be likely to add to this in the near future. But this is literally as good a foundation for recruiting class as you're going to find anywhere else in the country right now. The Buckeyes are currently ranked number one in the 2017 class. Only one other program, I believe, has 10 commits, and that's Miami. And I bet quite a few of those are going to change even before we get to June or July.
Well, and it's interesting. This is something that I think you've written about in recent weeks, and we've talked about on the podcast, getting back to just the Ohio State roster and the smallness of this class. And you look at how many guys were redshirted this year. Urban Meyer, after signing day, came out and said, I know we say it every year, but we don't want to redshirt guys. We want to have guys come in and play, and that's what they've always said. And really, we haven't seen that over the history of this team. And now it looks like next season, with 10 guys leaving early and you have five other seniors who are probably going to get drafted, it looks like on paper that there are spots to fill. I think when you look back at last year's class, it's not like the freshmen coming in this year are just going to jump those guys. You have guys like Mike Weber and Justin Hilliard, depending on how he comes back from injury, and others that were blue chip guys the year prior. So I think something to look for come spring ball is how much those kids that were freshmen last year have benefited from that redshirt year and are looking to step up and take those places of the guys who've left. Because I don't think it's a lock that all these freshmen are going to come in and play. I think maybe some of the receivers and the defensive ends that we talked about last week are going to fill those spots, but I'm not totally convinced that the blue chip guys from last year's class are just going to be so willing to give up their spots to the younger guys.
Yeah, there's going to be some really strong competition that's going to be coming in, and I would not be surprised if we see a little bit of attrition when you have so many younger players coming in here, and there's just not that much space where if someone finds themselves past on that depth chart early and you still got 3 years of eligibility to go, where they might decide to leave to leave and go elsewhere. That might mean I don't want to dig into specific names here, but I would not be shocked if there is some attrition among the wide receivers and offensive lineman group, where you might find some players who are passed by kids who've already been recruited, and that's going to open up some spots. Real quick, we just have some breaking news. As we were talking about Ohio State's 2017 class, they just added another player coming in here on the Twitters. That a 11th player, another blue chip, has just tweeted that he is verbally committed to the Buckeyes. And that is Haskell Garrett, a 4-star defensive tackle from powerhouse Bishop Gorman High School in Las Vegas. This would be, I think, definitely a sight for sore eyes for Ohio State fans who have complained strongly about defensive tackle recruiting. That's been a position where Ohio State has missed on a couple of targets over the last couple of years. They already have one blue chip out of Ohio in this class, and now they're getting a kid with a .9617 composite ranking. He's a top 100 player, the 4th-ranked defensive tackle, and the 3rd-best player in Nevada, and somebody who reports offers from Notre Dame, USC, Texas A&M, UCLA, a slew of other Western powers, and the Buckeyes. on paper right now, I mean, like I'm getting this literally as it's coming in. That is a profile of somebody who seems exceptionally exciting. You're going to find out more information about him on landgrantholyland.com. I would also not be shocked if other people are going to still be calling after him, given that it's a long ways to National Signing Day. But if he sticks with the Buckeyes, that's a great pickup at a great position of need. So naturally, as soon as I sit down here to do podcasting, that's when some big news breaks. So you'll have lots of things here to look forward to, and that's going to really solidify Ohio State's hold here on that number one spot here for 2017.
Yeah, and that's like you're saying, that's a position of need and one that I think all fans have looked at with kind of disappointment in terms of recruiting. I know we saw a great play this year, and I think a little bit undervalued play from Adolphus Washington, who didn't get enough credit, I think, compared to other players on the defensive line. And even Tommy Shutt played well at times. And I don't know too much about Haskell Garrett other than that just sounds like a name of somebody who's going to maul running backs inside and give the quarterback maybe a late shot here and there, bring some attitude to the defensive line, especially out of Las Vegas. But like you're saying, that's a big pickup. Who knows if it'll stick? But to have 11 kids of such caliber be committed this early, that's only good news for Ohio State.
Yeah, absolutely. So one other thing that recruiting rankings, we see that they're correlated with success. We see that they're great for bragging rights. That's something that we're going to talk a lot about here over the offseason. They're also a fairly big chunk of what constitutes the advanced stats previews and the advanced stat data early in the season before we're able to get in a bunch of other information over the course of the year. The one, if you're a regular Land Grant reader or a regular reader across other SB Nation properties, you've probably at least heard of something called the S&P Plus. Those are advanced stats that Chad on our website writes a lot about. It's run by Bill Connolly on SBNation.com. And that's a system that is able to help rank teams by using efficiency statistics, not just who you beat, but how you beat them and when you beat them on a per-play basis. And that's been a really useful tool to kind of determine which teams are good and by how much and compare them to another. Yesterday, the first preseason S&P Plus projections came out. We had all the way too early top 25s. We wrote one. Ohio State's kind of floating around between 6, 7, and the mid to late teens on those lists. Now here's one that comes out after National Signing Day, after kids have declared for the NFL. Ohio State clocks in at 14 in the early rankings. That is the second highest team in the Big Ten. They are behind Michigan, which is at 6. Ohio State also will play three teams currently projected to be in the top 25. They have the home game with Michigan, and then they have Michigan State, who is at 22, and an out-of-conference game against Oklahoma, who is ranked 4th. I've been looking through here on Ohio State's schedule. I believe there's only like 3 or 4 teams that are outside the top 50 that are going to be on Ohio State's schedule. Indiana's just a shout past there. They're at 56. Maryland is at 62, so they're pretty close. There's really only two, according to this, just abjectly terrible teams that are on the schedule. You have Rutgers clocking in at 87th and Tulsa at 93rd. That's who Ohio State plays in the second week of the season. Colton, I know you've had a chance to look at some of this data. Do you feel like Ohio State is appropriately ranked, and is there anything on their list of opponents that surprises you or changes the way that maybe you're thinking about that team?
Well, I think you look at the 14th ranking, and that seems about right because you look at the different weights or the different categories that are weighted in these. One is recruiting impact, in which Ohio State is ranked 5th, and then returning production, which is 18th. And I think that having them 14th is a fair assessment because they're not only losing so much production, but that production is high level. You're losing maybe the best defensive player in all of college football, one of the best linebackers, one of the best defensive tackles, maybe the best safety tandem in the country, and one of the best corners in Eli Apple, and that's not even getting to Mike Thomas, Braxton Miller, Taylor Decker on the offensive line. So I think Ohio State being ranked 14th is more a matter of just the unknown, that who's going to step up to fill these guys' places. They may be top-level recruits, but we just don't know anything about him yet. So I think it's more of a conservative projection. And I know that these aren't humans that are doing the projections, but you can't blame the computer for seeing what Ohio State's bringing back and thinking, well, maybe 14th, 15th. But even then, I think that goes to show how much talent is coming up in the pipeline and how much it believes in the recruiting impact that Ohio State would lose every single one of those guys and still be ranked 14th. I didn't even mention maybe the best running back, arguably, in the country in Ezekiel Elliott. So it just goes to show how much talent is leaving, but how much talent is still there yet to come. I'm kind of surprised that Michigan is up in the top seven. I think that they have a legitimate case of being a top 10 team when we're looking at Ohio State opponents. Returning production, they're ranked fifth, and recruiting impact 14th. They've still brought in good classes prior to Jim Harbaugh under Brady Hoke. But there's still something about them that I think doesn't scream top level to me. I think that they're probably going to be in the same boat as they were this year. I know that they have to find a new quarterback. I'm not in love with what they do at running back or wide receiver or at some of the skill positions other than Jake Butt at tight end. The defense is going to be nasty. But to me, it just doesn't seem, at least right now, that they're at that top level. And then you look too at Oklahoma, I think I don't have any qualms about them being in the top five. They're a team that'll probably be the best opponent on Ohio State's schedule.
Yeah, we talked a lot about this, I think, in the newsroom regarding Michigan. And that was a team that the advanced analytics system really loved throughout the duration of the year, even if maybe when you watch them with your eyes, I guess it's possible that we're all just irredeemably biased about Michigan. But given that their offense did have some flaws. Now, down the stretch, their passing game improved dramatically, and their defense was statistically completely dominant. If you don't allow anyone to score on you, for a couple of those games there in the beginning of the season, teams are barely even crossing the 50, that level of statistical dominance, even if your offense is only above average, is going to play really well into that system. And so Michigan was like a top 10 team for most of the year last year. Based on those, I would imagine that's going to carry over along with the fact that they've recruited very well. So I'm not necessarily sure if Michigan finishes the season in the top 10. It obviously is going to depend on what they're able to get from John O'Korn, since it doesn't look like they're bringing in any other graduate transfers to compete for that spot, or if Brandon Peters comes out of the gate and is awesome. But I don't hate it. I would probably still have Michigan as my preseason Big Ten favorite myself, just because, talent or not, Ohio State's going to be young everywhere except for quarterback next year. And I think people might be overrating the difficulties that come from losing that kind of talent ahead. I was a little bit surprised by how well a lot of the middle-of-the-pack Big Ten teams are faring in here. I thought Maryland was absolutely horrendous last year. I can't recall. I mean, I ended up watching a fair amount of Maryland football, and I can't recall really any time throughout the season where I thought, like, this is a competent football team. Even when they beat what ended up to be a pretty decent South Florida team in the beginning of the year, it seemed a lot of that was because of South Florida mistakes or their own failure to execute. The Terrapins do have what I think could be the basis of a pretty decent offensive line, but there's some real big questions at linebacker, and there's still that gaping hole at quarterback that I don't think they really filled in this recruiting class. And yet they're kind of close to being an average team statistically from these projections. You know, same thing with Indiana, which I think is going to have some really big questions to answer, replacing a lot of important production along their offense, about statistically an average team. So like that surprises me a little bit. But I will say, if you look at the balance of all of Ohio State's schedule, using the S&P as just kind of a rough sketch for what it looks like, this year's slate is going to be a lot harder than last year's. And Ohio State's going to be in a less experienced position to handle it, and there's some difficult road trips back-to-back. So if they're able to win 10 games or have a comparable performance to last year, I think that's going to be a pretty significant accomplishment.
Yeah, and I can't really imagine that complacency is going to be an issue. I know certain people brought that up at the end of the season. Well, that's why they didn't make the playoff. Maybe they thought it was too easy, or they got a little bit complacent. Even if that was the case, I don't think it'll be this year. Like you're saying, even the middle pack of the Big Ten, it's not what it was a couple of years ago. I think it's much stronger. Even you look at a team like Penn State, who's losing Christian Hackenberg. They're still bringing back some great running back talent. The offensive line is trash, quite frankly. But they still have talent along each side of the line and in the back end. And I think that you bring up Maryland and teams like Indiana. It's hard to get behind those teams because we watch them in the Big Ten East, and Indiana more so than Maryland, just because they're the chaos team and they play everybody tough. But those teams, you look at the record, and it's kind of deceiving, because they have to play Michigan State, Ohio State, Michigan, and then if they have a crossover game with Wisconsin or Iowa or even have to go on the road to Penn State, it's a lot tougher than it was, and I think it goes to show how the Big Ten and the recent coaching hires, especially in the East, have made the conference much stronger than what it has been in the last decade historically.
We actually had something else on SBNation.com that talked about that a little bit earlier today with some really improved recruiting within the Big Ten East, about how that entire division is really on the up and up, including some of the proverbial teams outside of these powers, your Indiana's, your Maryland's, your Rutgers. And that disparity now between the Big Ten East and the Big Ten West in terms of just bringing in prospects is really pretty glaring. I think 81% of the blue chip prospects at the Big Ten signed entirely went to Big Ten East schools. Between that one and then the disparity between the ACC divisions are the biggest in college football. I don't know if Maryland or Rutgers or maybe even Indiana are going to be that good. I'll have to look at their schedules and kind of try to suss out what's possible for them, since I think they all have some big roster holes and it's going to be in a tough division. But I think that baseline of play, especially for Indiana, definitely gone up. It's going to be an interesting year.
Just looking at Maryland's schedule right now, they have a stretch from October 8th until November 19th where they play at Penn State, home against Minnesota, Michigan State at home, at Indiana, at Michigan, Ohio State at home, at Nebraska. So to your point, I think the end of the season is going to be a little rough for the Terrapins.
Yeah, and if they, if they get one quarterback injury or one left tackle injury, the beginning of the season could be pretty rough for them too. Looking at this kind of from a national perspective, outside of just the Big Ten, I think if you look at some of these early projections, there's a couple of numbers that jumped out to me that seemed really surprising. And one of them, I think if you watch just a lot of college football, you probably heard about this team a little bit as like, this is definitely going to be somebody to watch for next year, even though on paper they didn't always look that great, and that's Washington. And don't look now, but Washington is ranked 10th in the preseason S&P Plus projections. And if you think that that's just because Bill Connelly messed up his math, ESPN has a similar ranking called the FPI that came out today, and Washington is 13th. So this is a team that was extremely young last year. I think they had a true freshman quarterback. They had underclassmen running backs, underclassmen all over their defensive front. And even though they had a relatively pedestrian record, I think they finished 7-6 and they beat Southern Miss in a bowl game. They played very well in their losses. So they didn't get just completely clown stomped by anybody. And they showed improvement over the season and they returned a bunch of production. I'm not sure if I'm willing to buy the Washington Huskies as a top 10 team. I do buy them as a top 25 team, or a team that's going to really make some noise in a really spicy Pac-12 North race, since you have like an actual good Washington State. Oregon is looking a little bit less dominant, and Stanford's replacing some parts. So they're going to be fun to watch. I don't know if they're necessarily that good. The other one that jumped out to me on this list, it was a little bit surprising because this is a team that's going to be ranked really high up later on in the beginning of the season, and that's Houston. Houston, the darling kind of P5 team, probably going to be in the preseason top 16, defending Peach Bowl champion. The analytics are not high on them. They have Houston as 53rd. So they're not even listed as the American Athletic Association favorite, and they are behind such luminaries in the college football world like Syracuse, Minnesota, Georgia Southern, and Boston College, who scored, I think, maybe 7 points last year. So the math seems to think that maybe Houston was a little bit lucky, a little bit fortunate, and even though they recruited really, they signed a top 10 player in the country, who should start immediately at defensive tackle, they like South Florida and some other Group of Five programs a little bit more than Houston, which is, I think, very different from how the pollsters, coaches, and media personnel are going to see things. Did anything else jump out at you that really surprised you one way or the other?
Well, to your point, I think Washington has to be, it's the easy answer on this, being in the top 10. We brought up returning production as being one of those big weights in this whole process, and Washington, is ranked, I want to say, 6th in returning production. And Jake Browning was a freshman last year. I thought from what I saw at quarterback, he got better as the season went on. I think that Chris Peterson has them going in the right direction. Looking at their schedule right now, they get Stanford at home. They have to go on the road to Oregon. They also get USC at home, and they have to go on the road at Utah. So like you're saying, I'm not positive that they're going to be a top 10 team. as the year winds down. But I do think that they will be a very good team. And outside of Stanford and to a lesser extent Oregon, just because we don't know what's going to happen with the quarterback situation, the Pac-12 North has kind of been up in flux at least last year. So I think that Washington maybe can make a run at it this year. If not this year, then next year as Browning turns into a junior. But sticking in the Pac-12, I think you have to look at USC. They're second in recruiting impact, returning production there in the top 15. They're in the top 15 in the weighted five-year rankings. And other than Cody Kessler, I think that they bring back so much talent on offense between Adoree Jackson, Juju Smith-Schuster, and then Ronald Jones, the second, one of the most talented freshman running backs in the country. I think he's going to turn into a legitimate star this next season. And Justin Davis, too, he almost rushed for 1,000 yards as well. I think USC might have the best combination of running backs in the country, and I think that they're probably the team to beat in the Pac-12, even over Stanford or some of the other ones. I think that USC, with Clay Helton, they've hopefully gotten past all their issues with coaching. The talent's there, and maybe other than Alabama, LSU, Ohio State, I think they have the most talent in the country. And I'm going to go out on a limb right now and say they're my team to look out for this year to make a run to the playoff. I think that they're legit.
You know, I agree with everything you've said, except for potentially the coaching situation, since I am a Clay Helton skeptic. But I feel like I have been burned by this every single year I've been doing it. I had USC as a playoff team this year. I think I had Cody Kessler winning the Heisman, because I'm a big, stupid idiot, and you shouldn't listen to the words that I say or that I write on the internet. Talent's never been the issue at USC, and now depth is coming back here. It's been about execution. It's been about consistency. It's been about institutional stability. Now they're going to be changing athletic directors. They've gone to the same well for their coaching, you know, all over their coaching pool again. They could finish the season third in the country. They have the personnel to do it, but I'm not going to put my tiny, what's left of my credibility at stake, pushing for that again, because I've been burned so many times. That's not a non-reasonable thing to say, though.
That's like me picking Villanova to go to the Final Four constantly in the NCAA tournament bracket. And I'm with you on Clay Helton. I don't think that that's a guy that I would put up as one of the best coaches in the country. But I think with USC, it's gotten to the point where if the coaches can just get out of the way, so to speak, and just let the talent take over and really not bungle it up, then I think that they should at least be in the conversation. Maybe if they get into a matchup with, say, Ohio State or Alabama, or Clay Helton has to match up with another one of these great head coaches, maybe that's where schematically or strategically they get exposed. But just on a pure talent basis, it's hard to see everything they have and not be enticed by it.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's all reasonable. Real quick, a couple of other names I think higher up on this list that may surprise a few people. Ole Miss is seventh. Even though Ole Miss is replacing some pretty significant chunks from last year's team, you know, like Ohio State, they brought in a really kind of transformative 2013 recruiting class, and a lot of those players are now leaving early to go to the NFL after being juniors. But Ole Miss has been a recruiting power in the Hugh Freeze era, and that's really kind of not been the case for that school throughout their recent history. And at that point, like, after this season, I think there's a credible argument that they have one of the, like, eight most talented rosters, period, in all of college football. So I don't know if they're going to be able to develop a running game. They have some questions here about their linebackers. Obviously, that division is always going to be very tough. I think they play Florida State in the out-of-conference. They're going to have a difficult schedule again. I have them much lower on my preseason top 25, but that's definitely a team that you're going to have to talk about. And then Tennessee is now ninth. And you know, they're probably your SEC East favorites in a division that's undergoing a little bit of flux at the moment. There'll be a lot of people who are happy to tell you that Tennessee is overrated. Their first big win over a decent team, I think, under this coaching administration would be their first. But now that they've recruited like gangbusters, they've been young for the past couple of seasons, I don't think it's crazy to have them up there. So those are a couple of the big things here. We'll see as these numbers get tweaked and evaluated, and after spring camp, which is crazy. Like, that starts in a month for many programs, or maybe even less. I think if you're Duke, they might have their spring game actually in February.
we'll evaluate those a little bit more. But the greater football storylines are starting to get confirmed up here.
Just as a side note, as an aside, you bring up Duke. They always seem to have their spring game early. David Cutcliffe has taken it on easy street on signing day. He's done by 8 a.m., and I think there was a report saying he was just out there watching TV or out playing golf or something. They have their spring game in February. David Cutcliffe may have low-key the best job in college football, and kudos to him for turning around that Duke program, but they got it made out there.
You may not be wrong, because expectations at Duke are going to be a little bit lower, given how bad they were for so long. To just be a perennial bowl team, you're going to be very satisfied. You have some warm weather. You're bringing in an improved caliber of player that's coming in. It's not really especially dramatic. You may not be wrong. That was actually something we talked about earlier, and I think we can save that for another podcast, with the easiest or hardest athletic director or coaching jobs were. But speaking of Duke, I'm going to get you out of here on this, because I actually have to leave the studio in a little bit, because the serious professional reporters of Vox.com are starting to give me the look that they need to come in here and talk about issues. But I'm going to North Carolina again tomorrow. I'm going to be gone here for a couple of days to go see my mom. And have you been there?
I have been to North Carolina. My grandparents lived out in Gastonia, North Carolina, for quite a long time. So I've made a few trips out to the great state of NC.
So I think, low-key, one of my favorite things about going down to visit my mom, going down there, she lives in Greenville, and I'm in the Triangle area on a somewhat regular basis, too. Yeah, it's the weather is great, and I know some of these cities are changing, and there's always positive things here. But low-key, one thing that I really love about that state, fast food game, very strong. I live in suburban Washington, D.C. in Maryland, and we don't have access to a lot of the most delicious fast food places. There is one Bojangles in this entire stupid city, and it's in Union Station, where all the trains are, and it's not even a full Bojangles. And I can go down and visit my mom, and they have Cookout, where I can drop like $10 and get like four dinners, which is amazing. You have all of the fried chicken places. You have all the fast food barbecue, and it's great. I'm curious, especially because I have not been out to your neck of the woods in Colorado. I don't know what like the Mountain West region like signature fast food place is, but is like, I don't know, is there anything better than Cookout?
Well, Colorado fast food is incredibly weak. If I had to match it up with a college football team, I would say Colorado fast food is the Colorado football of fast food in the nation. It's just not very good. We have one Raising Cane's up in Fort Collins, so every once in a while I'll make the 30-minute, 45-minute trek from Boulder up to Fort Collins to go to the Raising Cane's. But other than that, it's just your regular joints, Wendy's, McDonald's. There really is nothing special when it comes to fast food or even really food out here. I hope we don't have any listeners out here in Colorado, too, to come hunt me down for my hot take. But food-wise, Colorado doesn't really have an identity, just one Raising Cane's, and that's about it. We live a sad existence out here, food-wise.
Well, what you do is you live a healthy existence, and that's really the important thing. Like, I'm nearly 30. And I don't get a chance to exercise as much as I would like during football season, especially when I was hamstrung by a toddler. And so I'm not quite in my optimal fighting shape, which means that when I am tempted by Cheerwine milkshakes and, you know, copious amounts of chopped pork and then every kind of fried chicken, like that slows me down a lot more than it did maybe 8 years ago. You know, or when I'm in college and I could go wreck a rallies on your campus or something. And it isn't as I could go play basketball in 4 hours. I can't do that anymore. So maybe being in Colorado is long term the best play. But I don't think you could really go wrong with a lot of the options there. Here and where I am, there's really no. We have a Popeyes that's near my house, and that's about it. Everything else is artisanal and supposedly upmarket, and then like, you know, $8 more than it should be, and I'm just not that fancy of a person. So that's probably another reason why I don't really fit in here on the East Coast.
Between our food takes and ending last week's show with Pokemon, I'm sure the Vox Media executives that are watching you right now are completely thrilled with what's going on.
Oh, do you, listen, we have to wrap up, but I had a lot more Pokemon takes to talk to you about, because there was the Pokemon commercial during the Super Bowl. You've got Richard Sherman talking about his holographic Charizards. We're going to have to hold that for next week for more hot Pokemon takes.
But right, that's really the most important part of the podcast. Anyway,
it's really the most important part of what I do for a living. Like, you know, I'm the college football takes are just here to supplement what I really want to do, which is you know, expound more upon Pokemon Red, Blue, and Yellow. Anyway, I have to go, my friend. Colton, real quick, people on the internet, where can you find Colton Denning?
They can catch me at DubsCo, DubsCo, and also posting stuff on the LandGrant Facebook. In the coming weeks, I will have a post about comparing Ohio State to where Alabama was in the 2010-2011 range and seeing if we can't take anything from that.
I dig that. I like it. So I'm going to be out for the next couple of days. You're not going to see my byline for a little while after this post, but there's a bunch more information about Ohio State's defensive tackle commit that broke while we were on the air. You've probably already read about it by now. You'll find some more information about that. You'll have some more information about Ohio State's basketball team, which is fighting for their postseason lives. And by postseason, I also mean NIT, starting tonight against Northwestern and then closing out the rest of the season.
CBI champions.
See, yeah, you, look, they give you a trophy, don't they? I think they do. You get a banner. All right.
I don't know if we're ready for the CBI trophy takes.
Trophies are trophies, man. Give me all your hardware. I am your host, Matt Brown. I am the managing editor of LandGrant Holy Land. Find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Blog Talk Radio, on iTunes. We're all over the place. And tell your friends that if they like Ohio State, or even if they don't like Ohio State and like another college football team, to visit the SB Nation property of their choice, because I am a company man. Anyway, this has been fun, and we'll talk to you again soon. Go Bucks!